available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website. This is Outlook, the talking newspaper for Coventry.
Hello and welcome from me, Nigel Hewin, to this week's edition of Outlook, being recorded on Wednesday, the 5th of November, 2025. Bonfire night it is. And what's in this edition? Well, firstly, that Lane is going to go to Norton Lindsay Village, followed by an interview with Chris McCausland, that blind comedian who won Strictly last series. And you may have thought about these funny names we give to these old people like Ivan the Terrible. Well, maybe we're not getting it right. He may not be terrible. Peter's going to tell us all about it, at any rate. And 50 years ago, Angela Rippon became the first female newsreader. We'll find more about her life as well. And finally, we're going to have a visit to Hull with Dave and Graham. They're going to find out about the fishing village there. But very finally, I should say, there's a very short poem from Elaine about this autumnal month of November. And of course, there's also your postbag, sport and news from the Hub. But as ever, we're going to start with a roundup of the local news with Peter and Elaine.
Outlook News.
A tantalising 16th century gold ring discovered in Warwickshire, which may have belonged to one of the gunpowder plot conspirators, is expected to make between £8,000 and £12,000 at auction later this month. Bearing the sinister inscription, "Your friend indeed," the ring was discovered by a metal detectorist next to the Warwickshire birthplace of the plot's mastermind, Robert Catesby. Experts dated to the late 16th or early 17th century, when several plotters were staying at the hall. The inscription may hint at both the close bond between the conspirators and a pledge of allegiance to the deed of attempting to blow up Parliament on November the 5th, 1605. According to the British Museum, such an inscription is unknown on any similar ring, but at the time the gold bands, known as posy rings, were given as gifts among male friends to symbolise affection, allegiance or support between allies. It was unearthed last September by metal detectorist Andrew Rose, 6 inches deep, in a recently ploughed field adjacent to the moated Bushwood Hall in Lapworth, where Catesby was born in 1572. He said, "The hall where Catesby was born can only be accessed down a track, which means it is even more likely the ring, which was found only yards from the moat, was connected to the hall or was owned by someone who lived there." The words, "indeed," suggest whoever gave the ring was prepared to prove his loyalty in actions rather than just words. It was a great find and hugely exciting. At the time of the plot, the hall was being used as a base for the plotters, with Catesby stockpiling weapons and supplies. It was also home to one of the key conspirators, John Wright, who had been at school with Guy Fawkes in York. Had the plot to kill King James I succeeded, the plotters planned to put the Midlands at the heart of their ongoing revolt, but they were undone by an act of betrayal, likely from one of their numbers, who wrote an anonymous warning letter to one of the lords, advising him to stay away, and were either killed or executed. Charles Hanson from Hanson's Auctioneers said, "Guy Fawkes, Catesby and their network, many of whom were related by blood or marriage, moved between safe houses in the Midlands. They were protected by the region's large Catholic base, who were, like them, against the king. Given the remoteness of the hall's location, its link to Catesby, the date and inscription of the ring, it is tantalising to imagine it belonging to one of the plotters. Just imagine it glinting by firelight as they planned one of the most audacious attacks in UK history."
A £36.7 million council-funded water park has attracted about 1 million fewer visitors a year than was predicted before it opened. The Wave in Coventry City Centre opened in October 2019. Forecasts of 1.3 million annual visitors were repeatedly published in council reports between 2014 and 2019, compared to about 800,000 each year at the old Sports and Leisure Centre. These reports were used to inform the public and to persuade councillors to approve building the Wave and closing the old site, despite thousands petitioning against the move. But these predictions were wide of the mark. The council retains ownership of the site with about 2.4 million visits recorded over the Wave's first full 5 years, just over a third of the 6.5 million forecast. The park's first year of opening in 2020 was actually its most successful, recording nearly 1 million visitors despite COVID. However, the site's worst figures were recorded in the following year, with only 211,000 visitors. In 2022, there were 300,000 visits, 420,000 in 2023, and 450,000 in 2024, compared to the forecast of 1.3 million. The park is occasionally open for specialist sessions, such as parent and toddler groups, but general admission is restricted to school holidays and to Friday evenings and weekends during term time. Councillor Gary Ridley, the Conservative opposition leader on the council, described the difference between the predicted figures and those actually recorded as a huge chasm. "We were either sold something that was never going to happen, or another theory is it's just not attracting the numbers it should," he said. He questioned the policy around opening times, adding it was difficult to see how we're going to get 1.3 million people visiting this facility if it's only open at certain times. He added there were questions also that need to be answered around the pricing structure for the Wave. A visit for a family of four would cost £56. Or £49.50 with the discount for those who live in Coventry. Labour councillor Cameron Khan, the council's cabinet minister for sport, member for sport, said he thought the pricing was fair and pointed to extra discounts for certain groups, such as students and those on benefits. He also said the site was generating money and had allowed a new 50-metre pool to be built at the Alan Higgs Sports Centre, replacing the loss of the Olympic-sized swimming pool at the former Sport and Leisure Centre. One organisation, though, which its staff said had benefited from the development of the Wave, is community cafe Coffee Tots. The charity, which provides parenting support to families, looked set to close after it had to leave its former home in the now-demolished City Arcade. But in 2023, CV Life, who run the Wave, invited Coffee Tots to move there. Ros Mortimer from the charity said the new location felt like a community hub and was a busy, thriving venue. They'd seen their weekly visitor numbers rise from about 10 to 210. She said the Wave, CV Life, have actually been so supportive. The community feel has been incredible. We feel really blessed and actually fortunate that we've been able to have this opportunity and that it's working and that we're able to work alongside each other so nicely.
The power of community, creativity and compassion is being celebrated at Coventry's annual Peace Festival this month. Taking place from November the 1st to the 16th, this year's festival reflects Coventry's role as a city of peace and reconciliation, with 2 weeks of free events and activities. This year's programme marks the poignant 85th anniversary of the Coventry Blitz, with events and activities reflecting on the city's resilience, creativity and community spirit. A highlight will be a monument installation in the city centre, inspired by Coventry Cathedral. The old Coventry Cathedral, using 1,300 specially made cardboard boxes crafted by people of Coventry. Standing around 20 metres tall, the structure will symbolise unity, remembrance and hope. The Lord Mayor's Peace Lecture, delivered by international human rights activist Mandy Sanghera, OBE, will take place on Thursday, November the 6th at Coventry Cathedral. Her talk will explore her pioneering work supporting victims of honour-based violence and cultural abuse, and how communities can stand together against injustice. Other highlights include a workshop on the heritage craft of wood carving, inviting participants to carve their own Dove of Peace on Tuesday, November the 11th, and the annual Remembrance Sunday service and parade at the War Memorial Park on Sunday, November the 9th. A student-led discussion on digital peacebuilding takes place on November the 13th, and a civil service and vigil at Coventry Cathedral to mark the 85th anniversary on Friday, November the 14th. Saturday, November the 15th brings Reborn Phoenix, an artistic collaboration inspired by George Wagstaff's sculpture, and it takes a city, a moving promenade performance telling the stories of bomb disposal crews during the Blitz and beyond. Councillor Abdul Khan, Deputy Leader of Coventry City Council and Cabinet Member for Events, said, "The Peace Festival reminds us of the power of community, creativity and compassion. As we mark 85 years since the Blitz, we reflect not only on our city's past, but also on our shared responsibility to build a peaceful future. I invite everyone to take part in this year's festival, to learn, to share, and to celebrate Coventry's spirit of peace and reconciliation."
Tourism in Coventry has reached record levels, with the city's visitor economy valued at £922.9 million in 2024. An economic impact report, commissioned by Destination Coventry and the West Midlands Growth Company, showed that a total of 11.8 million people visited the city last year, up 3.6% on 2023, while the value of visitor economy increased by £67.9 million. Spending on overnight stays rose by 14%, while day trips made up 88% of all trips. Food and drink businesses were the biggest contributor to the visitor economy, making up 33% of direct spending, ahead of retail, which accounted for 29%. The City Council said the tourism sector supported over 8,000 jobs across Coventry and was driving investment, including in new accommodation projects. Councillor Jim O'Boyle, Cabinet Member for Jobs, Regeneration and Climate Change, said, "The tourism sector is really important, supporting a wide range of sector and providing good jobs for local people. It's great news that Coventry has yet again achieved record-breaking numbers for tourism." Corinne Crane, Chief Executive of the Coventry and Warwickshire Chamber of Commerce, added, "We're no longer just a well-kept secret, and as we continue to invest in first-class marketing assets and new models of business support, we know that these visitor numbers will just keep getting stronger."
Four Jaguar Land Rover employees who are former members of the armed forces will be supported by a 102-year-old D-Day veteran when they run the London Marathon. Jack Mortimer will be the team's honorary captain when they take to the starting line in London next April, in the hopes of raising £12,000 for the Royal British Legion. There are plans to assist Mr. Mortimer along part of the 26.2-mile route. "It's not about setting a personal best, it's about the physical feat for the four of us that are doing it. It's about creating a bucket list opportunity for a 102-year-old veteran who landed on Sword Beach on D-Day," said Stephen Lees, who is one of the runners. Mr. Lees and his three colleagues are part of JLR's Armed Forces Community Network and all work at the Gaydon site in Warwickshire. He said, "I served 20-odd years as an infantry officer, and Steve Chesel served in the Royal Electrical Mechanical Engineers. Dino Lotte served in the Royal Navy, and we've got Mike Warriner, who served in the RAF. Two of us hadn't really done any physical training since we'd left the armed forces over a decade ago. So we've been going on the couch to 5K, and then the 5K to 10K, and now we're going from 10K to sort of a half marathon before Christmas. Jack, who lives in Leeds, was a corporal with the Royal Army Ordnance Corps during World War II and was part of the Allied forces that landed on the 6th of June 1944. When he returned home from the war, Jack's sweetheart Flo made her first donation to the Royal British Legion in November 1945. She continued to do so every year throughout their 78-year-long marriage until her death a few days before Jack's 100th birthday. Mr. Lees said this was one of the reasons why they chose to run the London Marathon for the Royal British Legion and wanted Jack to be a part of that. Jack lives on his own in a flat. He's fiercely independent, but his wife of 78 years always contributed to the Royal British Legion, which is why they are our charity. She died 4 days before his 100th birthday a few years ago. So anything we can do to create those bucket list opportunities for this absolute legend, that to us is the really important piece. That's far more value than completing a marathon ourselves.
Continuing the charity theme, a group of volunteers has raised more than £100,000 for charity after taking on a five-day trek of the Himalayas. The Might and Hospices, based in Coventry and Warwickshire, thanked 49 of its volunteers who travelled to India before embarking on the hike. The charity said the money would go towards vital funding needed for patients and services to keep the hospice free of charge. The hospice's events and campaigns manager, Natalie Walker, thanked the group, adding, "Your support makes such a difference to our patients and their families." The volunteers started their journey in Delhi before travelling overnight to Dharamsala, home of the Dalai Lama and the Tibetan community. From there, they gathered at Bir in the foothills of the Himalayas to begin their five-day trek through forests, mountain passes and remote villages. The challenge concluded with visits to the historic Bajnath Temple and the Norbalinka Institute before the group returned to Delhi. Miss Walker said, "I'd like to say a big thank you to each and every person that took part in our Himalayan trek. It was such a wonderful and special thing to be part of it with you all. Your hard work, determination and fundraising is amazing." The charity said it cost £15.3 million a year to continue to provide its services free of charge. And with only 17% of its funding received from the NHS, this means it has to raise an additional £12.7 million, working out at over £1 million a month. And the hospice added, "We couldn't provide our vital services without the support of volunteers and people like our incredible trekkers."
The £10 million upgrade of streetlights in Coventry is set to begin. Energy-efficient LED lanterns will replace 28,847 traditional lights over the next 2 years, starting with those in the city centre. Coventry City Council said the first of the new lanterns were due to arrive this week, with contractor Balfour Beatty just waiting on legal documents to be signed. At a meeting of the Communities and Neighbourhoods Scrutiny Board, the council said the work will continue until November 2027. The new LED lighting will use almost half the current amount of energy and lead to savings of £900,000 per year. Ravinder Sekhon, the City Council Street Lighting and Support Services Manager, said the local authority was on target with its plans. Speaking at the scrutiny board, she said, "Balfour Beatty have lanterns arriving, so as soon as things are signed, they will be rolling them out. They have employed subcontractors who are all geared up. The dates are indicative and the list will be updated. It is a case of them dealing with things on the network like parked cars and access. And then there is an embargo around Christmas time. They need to factor all that in." She said where some streets cross ward boundaries, they will still be completed. Councillor Sayyag Bula asked why the Binley Willenhall ward was at the bottom of the list, with work not expected to start there until August 2027. The ward has over 2,000 streetlights, second only to Henley Ward. Second responded, "One of the things we had to take into consideration was the maintenance schedule and the quantity of lights in the wards and the amount of routes. It was decided to put it to the end because we could deal with it as a whole ward more effectively." She added that the heritage lamps in the city centre would be excluded from the upgrade because they are more expensive to replace. Options for these will be considered over the next 2 years.
A new immersive exhibition inspired by the experiences of a Coventry family will explore the impact of South Asian heritage on modern Britain. Stories That Made Us, Roots, Resilience, Representation, opens on the 14th of November at Herbert Art Gallery and Museum. It invites visitors to step through a series of rooms depicting key moments in time as South Asian communities adapted to social, political and cultural changes in the UK over five decades. The Living Exhibition has been created by Coventry artist and curator Hardish Virk and includes photographs, music, magazines, posters and family memorabilia, as well as oral histories and film. The journey begins in a 1960s passport control room filled with family photographs and newspaper cuttings before moving through a 1970s living room, 1980s teenager's bedroom and a radio studio celebrating the work of Mr. Virk's late mother, the poet and broadcaster Jasveer Kang. Mr. Virk said that the exhibition, which will run until May next year, showed one family's journey that acts as a catalyst to share a bigger story about Britain's relationship with South Asia over the centuries. Through that personal lens, we're inviting everyone, whatever their background, to connect, reflect, and find their own story in what they see. We are proud to host this extraordinary exhibition at the Herbert, said Margarita Nugent, Cultural Director at Culture Coventry Trust. It's an immersive, emotional and vital celebration of South Asian heritage and of Coventry's history as a city of migration, creativity and solidarity. The exhibition, which is supported by the National Lottery Heritage Fund, will also include an engagement programme designed to strengthen links with South Asian community groups in Coventry and beyond.
A West Midlands police dog described as a fierce protector has retired following a 7-year career that saw him take down thieves, armed robbers and carjackers. Police dog Wes retired from duty after turning 9 last month and had served his force since the age of 2 when he graduated from the dog training unit in Balsall Common. The German Shepherd will now spend his retirement with PC Marie Darby after they have spent the last 7 years working together. PC Darby said, "I'm so proud of Wes and what we have achieved as partners. He is an amazing police dog and I will miss working with him. I'm so happy that he gets to spend his retirement at home with me. Our police dogs are amazing and we simply couldn't do this job without them." Wes wasted no time in getting started when, on his second day, he detained a thief who tried to run from a stolen vehicle in Oldbury. In 2020, Wes detained a suspected armed robber attempting to flee a crime scene in a car. Wes and his handler blocked in the car and detained the man as he tried to run off. A taser, machete and CS gas were recovered from the vehicle, and following a search of the suspect's home, Wes also found a second suspect who was hiding. That same year, the dog detained a carjacking suspect in Walsall. In 2021, he stepped in after a man armed with a steering block and baton assaulted officers. The suspect tried to run off, but Wes was able to chase him down. And in 2023, Wes helped detain two suspects in the case of a knife point robbery in Birmingham city centre. A spokesperson for West Midlands Police acknowledged that on more than one occasion, Wes had jumped in to protect his colleagues. Only last summer, Wes stepped up to protect his colleagues after a suspect drove at officers, injuring two of them. Wes detained the driver before anyone else got hurt. Well done, Wes, and happy retirement.
A funeral director has issued a plea to other drivers after experiencing a lack of etiquette during funeral corteges. Andy Hawkins, one of the owners of Franklin Hawkins Family Funeral Directors in Tile Hill, said he had seen an increase in impatient drivers trying to overtake funeral processions. He pleaded with other road users to be more considerate and to think about the families of those who have passed away. Mr. Hawkins said, "I'd really like to see people just think that that could be my family and slow down." Speaking about recent experiences, he said drivers who tried to overtake the cortege were sometimes unable to and then had to pull in front of the limousines, interrupting the procession. He said it's happening at least two or three times a month. We've had people blasting their horns because they're in a rush to get past. Emergency vehicles always turn off their sirens and we've always moved out of the way for them. They seem to show respect when the general public sometimes can't. Another incident in Coventry saw a driver trying to overtake the cortege before noticing a car coming in the opposite direction. Mr. Hawkins said the driver had to swerve and ended up on someone's driveway. He said, "Please, please, if you see a funeral cortege, slow down and show some respect. We're driving slowly. It's a final journey for somebody. It's a family that we've got in these limousines." At one time, we'd get people standing on the road taking their hats off and lowering their heads as we go past. And believe me, that still sometimes happens. But now, drivers ought to make sure that in these circumstances, they think about others instead of thinking about themselves.
A watch made in Coventry more than 100 years ago is expected to fetch as much as $1 million when it is auctioned this month. Coventry's watchmaking industry may now have faded into obscurity, but its legacy lives on. The timepiece, set to be auctioned in Geneva, is the second most complicated one ever made by the J. Player and Son firm, according to Carl Player. It will be auctioned by Philips in Geneva on November the 8th and has a guide price of $502,000 to a million. Mr. Player told of how his family made the watch in 1907, and it passed through various owners over the years. It was last sold at Christie's Auction House in New York in 1993 by an anonymous buyer. The entry on the Philips website describes the watch as a remarkable timepiece, delivering a horological punch rarely seen at this level. J. Player and Son of Coventry are described as a firm of high-quality watch and clockmakers, known for their complex and ornate timepieces. The entry adds, "Founded by Joseph Player in 1858, the firm achieved a strong reputation for precision instruments outside of London's main horological centres, making pocket watches with advanced features like astronomical functions, alarms and thermometers. The Coventry firm is well known for making another famous watch in 1909 for American banker J.P. Morgan. It was the most complicated watch ever made by the firm, and Morgan paid £1,000, around twice the cost of a house in the UK at that time, for the piece. It is estimated that it would be worth around £10 million today, but sadly, it has been lost over the decades. By the First World War, J. Player and Sons had moved into making gearing for bicycles, but the watchmaking trade's legacy is preserved at the Coventry Watch Museum in Spond Street.
A young girl from Coventry who survived solely on breakfast cereal throughout her life has finally consumed her first proper hot meal following hypnotherapy treatment. Ella Fowler, aged 8, would break down in tears whenever anyone presented her with anything besides cornflakes, Weetabix or Frosties. She'd never sampled a home-prepared dish and even took cereal along to birthday celebrations, enjoying a bowl while her relatives consumed, for example, Christmas dinner. Her mother, Natalie, a store manager, said, "Ella's never eaten anything cooked on a hob. At home, it was cereal for breakfast, lunch and tea. She's never had a Christmas dinner. She went to her best friend's birthday party and there was a lovely spread of sandwiches, sausage rolls and crisps, but she had a bowl of cereal. And when she went round her friend's house, she had cereal and crackers." Ella began refusing nearly every meal when she reached 2 years old, forcing Natalie to serve her breakfast cereals for dinner instead. Her mother found herself purchasing countless boxes of cornflakes, Weetabix and Frosties each week to satisfy Ella's limited dietary requirements. Her mother explained, "I took Ella to the GP when she was about 5 and they said she'd grow out of it, but she never did. So recently our doctor had put her on an NHS waiting list, but we didn't know how long we'd be waiting for her to see a specialist, so we started looking online about kids with similar conditions." And indeed, listeners to Outlook may remember a very similar story that Elaine read a few weeks ago. Back to Natalie. "We came across eating disorder specialist David Kilmurray, and we were amazed by the results he had. People think it's just fussy eating, but it's not. It's fear. I'm so glad I didn't wait for the NHS. David was brilliant. I don't know how he did it." Ella received a diagnosis of ARFID. Avoidant restrictive food intake disorder, a condition that renders the aroma, flavour and texture of particular foods completely intolerable. Following just 2 two-hour hypnotherapy sessions with David, Ella has now sampled over 20 different foods, including fruit, vegetables, nuts and pizza. She even devoured a raw Brussels sprout, not quite sure why, and has pledged to consume all her greens going forward. David, who operates clinics in Coventry and Harley Street in London, commented, "ARFID isn't taken seriously enough. It doesn't just go away as children grow up. Food is medicine, and Ella is already making amazing progress."
3 otter cubs were found after a tree fell in parkland in Warwickshire and exposed their hidden den. The tree fell on the Compton Burnie parkland quite suddenly in this weather that we've been having before opening hours one Thursday. Compton Burnie landscape manager Fiona Tansey said, "The tree was being checked for the safety of visitors and a little noise was heard, and 3 little baby otters that had been underneath the tree were discovered." Ms. Tansey said it was thought that the only thing to do was to take them into our security where they were nice and warm. And the UK Wild Otter Trust charity was contacted. They had a volunteer out to us within 2 hours, which was absolutely great for us, because we were a bit worried that we couldn't look after these little pups. They were so small and still needed hand feeding. Dave Webb from the Trust said the rescuers saw the mother leave the holt, but she had not returned by the next day, so it left the cubs very exposed. Mr. Webb added the rescuers had done absolutely the right thing in rescuing the 5-week-old animals, as they were in immediate danger. He added the mother may have been spooked by the tree falling. The cubs, who are still vulnerable, are being cared for by the Trust. He explained that the volunteer who came via the charity would now hand-feed them for a few weeks before they went to a rehabilitation centre in Devon for a number of months. Compton Burnie said it was hoping that the cubs would return and it could release them when they were old enough at the same site where they were born.
A shoplifter who stole around £3,000 worth of chocolate in a spree of thefts in Coventry has been jailed. Richard Lake, aged 35, was sentenced at Coventry Magistrates Court to 36 weeks in prison after he admitted 18 thefts of chocolate from shops in Coventry. He was arrested by officers from the city's south-north-west sector, who identified him as responsible for thefts in September and October this year. Lake would enter shops and take chocolate before leaving without paying. Police estimated the total values of the chocolate stolen to be over £3,000. Detective Inspector Andrew Mitchum from Coventry Local Policing Area said, "This is an excellent result, which came off the back of some excellent local police work by my teams. All the neighbourhood teams on the south-northwest sector did an excellent job identifying Lake, sniffing him out and securing charges against him. We know the stress and anxiety businesses feel when they're targeted by shoplifters, and we're continuing to act decisively and to arrest wherever we can."
Outlook News.
And thanks to Elaine and Peter there for the local news. Now, just before we move on, we've got, of course, your sunrise and sunset time. Sunrise at the moment is 7:05 in the morning, and it's disappearing at 27 minutes past four in the afternoon. That's all the announcements I've got. But we've got two people in the studio tonight, today, from the Hub. There's Joe and there's also Chris. So welcome to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yes, so I've got a few items and Chris has got an item to talk about, so we thought we'd come together today and make a bit of change, won't
we? Goodbye, bad guy.
Goodbye.
Good
night. You can't say that, that's a tongue twister.
Yeah.
So, hello everybody, lovely to speak to you again, it's been some time. Hugh is away today at a visionary conference, so he's learning how to do things as a chief exec and that sort of thing, all very useful. He has been talking, I know, for probably some time now about the winter warmer, our Christmas fundraising party. So Saturday the 29th of November, we're hoping that many of you will be able to come. It'd be lovely if you could come with family and friends as well and widen our network a little bit. Starts at 11 and we'll run till 3. If the weather is decent, we might try and put some things outside because it was such a crush in there last year. If not, we'll just have another happy crush and we'll manage. And just to say as well, the Earlston Primary School Choir will be coming back this year to sing again, which was rather delightful last year. Mm. So we'll have them inside on the stairs and hopefully their voices will carry through where everybody else is in the building. If you are able to contribute to our tombola items, we'd be very grateful. We've had a few things coming into reception, so thank you to anyone that's already done that. If you've got some items you don't need, gifts that you haven't opened, or anything you think might be appropriate for tombolas, that would be great. Anybody who has a talent for crafting, if you want to contribute items for our craft sale. And one thing we really do well on quite often is cake sales. So if you are a baker or fancy being a baker, the cakes that sell really well on the day are the sort of loaf tins cakes. So easy to pack, easy to carry away with you, but they sell very well for us. So if you fancy making a few cakes and bringing them in for us the day before, that would be very welcome indeed. Next thing I want to mention is there's an event, a charity concert happening, run by the Stoneleigh Ladies Choir. That is going to be on Thursday the 11th of December at 1:30 in the afternoon in Stoneleigh Village Hall. The concert will start at 1:30. Tickets are available on the door, £10. And for that, you also get refreshments. So that's a pretty good price. And we won't be doing a day out from here for that event, but it might be something that you might want to go to with family members. And they are going to support us as a charity alongside Warwickshire Vision. So two Vision charities. And we're very grateful to, I know at least two of the people that are in the choir volunteer with us here, so thank you for suggesting it.
Do you know what sort of music they sing?
I don't.
Classical or
don't
pop
have any.
Or,
I think no, it's no, probably on the pop side of things,
or
but
such, from the musicals possibly.
Yeah, maybe. I don't think it's classical, but okay, I wouldn't want to say because I'm waiting for the bit more information to come in so we can clarify
plenty
that.
Plenty of time for that.
Yeah, there is. Yeah.
I think I've been to Stoneleigh Hall and it's lovely.
Is it?
So if you go, it's worth going just for the hall. I seem to remember it's really nice.
Yeah.
I mean, Stoneleigh in general is a lovely village, actually.
I'm going to try and get Hugh to go along, or if he can't do it, I will probably go along as well.
And go just, along.
Chris will be there.
Yeah. I'll never thought of Stoneleigh.
We've definitely had some dealings with the Stoneleigh Male Voice Choir before, and they were tremendous, and they sing classical mainly, but I don't know about the Stoneleigh Ladies. Mm. Anyway, we're very grateful to them, and I will put some more information out when we get it. Chris, do you want to mention your item?
I will. I just want to go back to the Winter Warmer, actually. A couple of people have asked if we'll be doing posh coffee again at the Winter Warmer this year. So I'm pleased to tell you that, yes, we will in fact be doing that. And to make it even better, we're going to see if there's a local cafe called Bean and Leaf who have given us what they're called, raffle prizes before. And so if they'll give us a bag of their. They have guest coffees in every couple of weeks, months, however long it takes you to drink them. And they're really nice. So we're going to see if they'll give us a bag of beans. So definitely posh coffee. So if you
what, what is posh coffee, please?
Well, at home, Claire and I, very much doesn't know, Claire, my wife, is a massive coffee snob. So she has a bean-to-cup machine, so you put beans in the top and delicious coffee comes out the bottom. And we brought it along, and people were like, oh, no one's going to buy the posh coffee because the instant's better and cheaper. And we couldn't make it quick enough. People loved it.
Yeah.
And then, yeah.
Once it does taste entirely different, doesn't it?
Oh, gosh, yeah. Like, I don't want to sound like one of them people, but it's a completely different experience drinking it to instant
stuff. Yes, I'm afraid I'm a bit of a coffee snob as well. We have a coffee pod machine in the kitchen here that staff use, so it does make a big difference. So, yes, so that will be available, Chris.
And beans are better than pods.
Lovely.
And the other thing, on the 13th of December, that's right, yeah, 13th of December, we are running a trip from the hub to the German Christmas market in Coventry, so not the Birmingham one, because that's a lot further away and our buses get charged if they go there. So, yeah, it's the Coventry one, so we're going to be picking people from home if you need picking up, although I know a lot of people can get to town already, so if you can make your own way there, that's all to the good. Meeting there, oh my gosh, I can't remember the times I said now.
12 o'clock.
Yeah, 12 o'clock. Meeting somewhere, probably outside the council house, because that's nice and easy for the bus to get to. We'll toddle along to Broadgate where the market is happening. There'll be 1-to-1 volunteer support. I hope that's what I'm going to try for. And then at 4 o'clock we'll head back. Obviously people are welcome to leave earlier if they want to, just let us know. But yeah, it should be a really good day out. There's loads of good stuff at the German market. I mean, obviously there's the German sausages, that's the main thing, the sausages and beer. But there's also craft stalls and all sorts of different stuff, and the music's really good. It's a great little event. It's really good fun.
Are we charging for that, Chris?
It's the normal whatever the minibus is these days. I'm trying to avoid saying numbers. I'm not
sure. £7 return.
£7 return. So I think it might be that. And then I think it's £6 for the trip. So for the guide and all that kind of thing. You'll need to pay for your own stuff. Bring along card and cash, whatever. I think most of the stalls are card only these days. So make sure you've got all that sort of stuff. And, make sure you bring a shopping bag, because you don't want to be finding loads of nice stuff and not being able to carry it back home.
And we're going to have a limit to the numbers, I think, aren't we, of 10,
yeah,
so that we can manage
people,
it all.
Yeah. If there are extras, we'll see what we can do. But, 10 is certainly the maximum we can get on the minibus.
So get your names down early, I would suggest.
Yeah, so let reception know, as usual.
Okay, lovely. Other thing I wanted to say, the last thing probably, Julia, who many of you know, has been very busy for the last 2 months or more, knitting and crocheting poppies, and she has been working hard to collect money for us as a charity and also for the poppy appeal. So I've got a letter here from Julia. If I could just read a bit of that out, that would be great. So she says, "Hello everybody, this is Julia. May I say a very big thank you to everyone that has contributed and donated to the handmade poppies that I made. I've made 155 glittery and plain poppies in total, and the money I have made will be donated to the Royal British Legion Poppy Appeal and the Vision Hub. I've raised £332 in total, so the money will be split in half," which is fantastic, isn't it? So well done to Julia. Thank you all for joining in with that. If you have any feedback for Julia on the poppy that you've had and how you've enjoyed it, or anyone that's been impressed with it, she would love to hear your feedback. So our thanks to Julia for her fundraising efforts, and thank you all for joining in with that. That was lovely. So I think that's everything from me.
Oh, are you mentioning the hole in the drive?
Hole in the drive, yes. The driveway at the front of the centre, some of you will know that we have a long strip of tactile paving, which is intended to guide people from the entrance off the pavement. It has been very damaged for a considerable time. We've been very aware of that and trying to get funding and all sorts of ways of trying to get money that we need to do a big job on resurfacing that and the car park around it. We haven't managed yet to manage to do that, but what we have done is, well, I say we as though I was out there with a spade, I wasn't, but Jeff and Mick have been very kindly out there yesterday and digging around the hole, pulling out the old stuff and concreting and putting on new tactile paving slabs where needed. So I'm hoping we've got the area marked off currently until tomorrow evening so that the concrete is set.
Yeah, little plastic cones. If you're using a cane, they do tend to move if you hit them. So just so you know about that.
There is tarpaulin over the top of it as well, so just stay to the left side.
They can
nearer
still get
to
in
the
drive.
The cars can't get in the drive.
Right, okay.
Pedestrians could, but we suggest everybody comes in the lower entrance until the end of play tomorrow.
So that's the one roundabout end, isn't it?
Tomorrow we should taste in the web. We're talking about Thursday this week, aren't we?
Because we're now on Wednesday. So by the time this goes out, it will all be sorted.
Good.
So, you know, our aim there is to make sure that it's not potholed like it has been and broken bits of paving and people getting water spurted up their trousers on the way through and all sorts. It's been quite hazardous. We are aware of that, so apologies. And, of course, it has to be robust because the traffic all goes over it, including two very heavy minibuses. So hopefully that job we've done on it will last for some time.
Full tactile guide way in then.
The same strip of tactile paving. Excellent. So you can use that as a guide to get you to the front door.
Good.
And we will be working on a longer term plan, but it may take some time.
Yep. Talking of water in your trousers, by the way, if anybody needs any coats, the charity shop here has got a lovely selection of winter coats at the minute. They've got tons of really nice stuff. So if anybody feels like you want to get even drier, then please come visit the charity shop.
There you are. That's it.
Thank
from
you very
Joe
much.
And from Chris, thanks very much.
Thanks,
I guess Hugh back next week?
Possibly? Hugh will be back next week, although Chris might be back in the chair, I don't know which.
Yeah, not next we week, I won't. I'm away next week.
Oh, you're away next week, yes. Yeah, so
I'll be
you.
The proper German marker next week in Germany.
Good, thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you.
And from News at the Hub to News of Sport with Sarah.
Well, hello there, lovely, lovely, lovely listeners, and welcome to what will be actually quite a short sport. I'm just covering football, rugby and cricket. Yes, I did say cricket. So I'm going to start, as usual, with football. On Friday, to accommodate the television, because it was televised, Coventry travelled up the M6, turn left, to the fair city of Wrexham. Now, the team of Wrexham, as I mentioned last week, have been very much bankrolled by this couple of Hollywood actors whose names I've never heard of, but I don't do films, too busy doing sport. And that was pretty evident when you saw their team sheet, one of whom includes Kiefer Moore, who really is the star of the Welsh team. He gets goals from almost nowhere. They'd also got three former City players, one who was a very short loanee whose name escapes me, Dom Higham, who was one of our really strong defenders, but we sold him to Blackburn Rovers towards the end of the Mark Robbins era. And Ben Sheaf, who was our captain up until October, when we sold him in the summer transfer window. Two other things to say before I tell you about the match. It is coming. The Wrexham Stadium, the racecourse ground, is currently three-sided because they're having a new fourth stand built. And apparently there was a big gap behind one of the goals, so it made cross kicks, corner kicks, very interesting because of the wind. And I know how that wind blows in North Wales. The other thing that tickled me was a quote by Lorna Bailey, who presents and coordinates the CWR coverage. She said, "Gosh, that grass is green. Do you think it's rain or do you think they've dyed it?" Well, I can tell you, Lorna, it rains in North Wales. So the match started, and Wrexham were like bats out of hell. But then, somewhat against the run of form, Tak Sakamoto passed a lovely ball to Ephraim Mason-Clark, who sent it goal-bound. So City took the lead, 1-0. But then, in the second half, in the 50th minute, Kiefer Moore scored. And then he scored again. And he scored again to make sure he takes the match ball home. Big dent in our goal difference. Although it was eased a little bit when Ephraim Mason-Clark repaid the compliment and passed a nice ball to Tak Sakamoto, who scored. So the final score was Wrexham 3, Coventry 2. But at that point, we were still top of that league. With 28 points and a goal difference of 24. So it meant basically, unless Middlesbrough won on the following day by 17 goals, we were still going to be top of the league going into next week's two matches. Well, I'm very pleased to say, and I've never been so eager at watching the Middlesbrough result, that Middlesbrough lost 3-0 to the team we destroyed last week, Watford. So we're still top 28. Middlesbrough are second on 25, with a paltry goal difference of 4. 20 goals less than us. And then in third place, and rather ominously, are a team called Stoke City. Now, Stoke are the team currently managed by our much-loved former manager, Mark Robbins. And guess who we're playing next Saturday, 3 p.m. at the Bet365 Stadium. You've guessed it, Stoke City. Although before then on Tuesday, we will have played Sheffield United. So I'll have to tell you all about that next week. So moving on quickly to the non-league teams. Well, Leamington's league had a week off this week, but Stratford entertained Bedford and I'm afraid they lost 3-2. Nuneaton Town, meanwhile, did win 1-0. But the team they beat was my lovely little Coventry United. Oh, well. Moving on quickly to the oval shape ball, our Coventry in rugby union. My heart sank somewhat when I saw that Coventry were away to Richmond. I remember the days when Richmond were one of the top teams. Oh, well, you can only play who you've got. Well, I was actually out for half of this match because it was a 2 o'clock kickoff. And when I switched it on, Cov were leading 14 points to 12, or 12 points to 14, because it's tradition to mention the away team first. Can they hold on? But I feared they wouldn't, knowing their recent record. Well, they did. In fact, they scored almost straight away to make it 12-19. But then we let Richmond score. But they couldn't convert either, so it was 17-19. And then Cov really turned it on and scored try after try after try to have a final score of Richmond 17, so no bonus point for Richmond, Cov 52, and all 5 points. Crisis? What crisis? And now for cricket! Oh yes, folks, I'm covering cricket. I'll get the men out of the way first. Well, our men's team in their ODI series against New Zealand lost the whole series 3-0. Move on. Meanwhile, the women were playing in the ODI World Cup. And as I mentioned last week, from the first round, well, where they played seven matches, the round robin, they were seeded second and were due to play South Africa in the semi-finals, which they duly did. And I'm afraid, unlike in the very first match, England were thumped, which meant that South Africa went through to the final. Mind you, things got quite a lot better on the following day because Australia, seeded one, were beaten by India, who had been seeded four and really only just made the semi-finals. And then I'm delighted to say that in today's final, I'm recording this on Sunday, India beat South Africa. Yes, I know it. The competition was in India, which gives them home advantage. But the delight in the crowd and the meaning it will give to the status of women and women's sport in India. I mean, when I switched on properly to listen, which was only the last half of South Africa's innings, they batted second. They were cruising it and they still got five wickets left and only needed about 150. And it was seen as easy peasy. And then they got to 110 or 111 with nine overs left. And it was like, oh yeah, they should make this. But then one wicket fell and another and another and another. And India won by 52 runs. They'd achieved 298 runs for seven, whereas South Africa were 52 less and were all out. And finally, if you've ever wished you'd worn a thicker T-shirt, I bet that applies to the man that came second in the New York Marathon. Up the home straight, there were two Kenyans battling it out, sprinting it out, and the one won, beating his compatriot by less than half a second. You'd run 26.2 miles, and you're beaten by half a second. Oh, what would you be thinking? I dread to think. Anyway, that has been your sport, and have a great week ahead, folks. Bye.
Thanks, Sarah. I reckon a couple of thick thermal vests could have got him first across the finishing line. How about it? And now let's find out from Dave what's in this week's postbag.
This is Postbag. Discussion.
Hello there and welcome to your postbag again. Elizabeth starts us off by telling you about a quiet garden tucked away in Aldsley Village, which you can go along to for some quiet relaxation, if you let them know beforehand. Here's Elizabeth.
Travelling around this week, I came upon a wonderfully tranquil secret garden, breathing space, in Aldsley Village. If you are in a low mood, I strongly recommend that you visit this garden. You can sit in solitude, listen to the birds, check out the fish in a lovely little pond. You can swing in a delightful swing on chains. You can take in the ambience of the garden and you slowly regain your equilibrium. Life is more serene. A lovely lady named Catherine came over for a chat and gave us tea and biscuits. There is a labyrinth outside, and incidentally, for anyone less mobile, there is a small labyrinth indoors which one can use. The visit was rounded off with a hearty bacon and egg roll at the community cafe. Very enjoyable.
Thank you, Elizabeth. That was lovely. Breathing space. A quiet garden is just to the left of the post office on the Birmingham Road in Aldsley Village, number 123B, Birmingham Road, Aldsley Village, CV59GR. It's available to all who need a bit of peace and tranquility. It's owned by a man called Peter, whose mum is a lady called Peggy, who goes to the bereavement group that I go to at Aldsley Church. She also came to the Monday Club to talk about her life in Hong Kong. You do need to be booked into Breathing Space. Phone Breathing Space on the landline 02475099426 or 02476713381. Email at breathingspacecoventry@gmail.com. They are normally open Thursday, Friday and Saturday, 10 a.m. till 4 p.m. For more information, the website is www.breathingspacecoventry.org. Elizabeth did an excellent report on the Coventry Music Museum recently and talked about the piano that mother of Rob Woodward played in the recording of their number one record, Mouldy Old Dough, in a house in Kingsway near the library on Ball Hill. Graham talks about the piano and whether it's the same one that he played on at the house.
Well, I have actually played that piano. Well, at least I have played his piano in his house, Stoke. It may not be the same piano. He may well have traded it in for another one between the time I played it and the time he recorded Dozy Old Doe. That's the name of the record. I've got it now. But I just thought I'd mention it anyway. I fear another clang has been made regarding phone numbers and regarding the news item about Age Concern's warm home scheme. It was a 10-digit number which was given. It's got to be 11-digit numbers in a UK phone number. I rather fancy it should have ended with 3 9s and not 2. Now that might not be Outlook's problem, it could be the way it appeared in the original item. But I thought I'd better bring it to somebody's attention. Okay.
Thank you, Graham, for that information about the piano and your experience. I looked up 2 websites for Age UK, and one number had 3 9s at the end, and the other had only 2. So I think you'll find that the phone number of Age UK Coventry and Warwickshire Warm Homes programme is 02476 231999. It's to help older residents stay warm this winter by offering a benefit entitlement check. The service provides a one-to-one session to help eligible residents to access financial support and ensure they are all receiving all the benefits they are entitled to. So that phone number again is 02476 231999. Here's another useful phone number, Bus on Demand, which Elizabeth also uses to get to her Macular Society, etc. Here's Jag Singh to talk about the great service.
Hi everybody, hope you're doing well. This is Jag Singh and I thought I'd share something with everybody. I've recently discovered Bus on Demand from West Midlands Travel. Their phone number is 0345 034 8670. This service is absolutely fantastic. I used to travel to places in a taxi, and sometimes a taxi driver would drop me not where I want to. When you've got limited eyesight, It is quite frightening to try and get to your location, especially in the dark. It's not always the cheapest way to travel either. But the guys who run the bus on demand service are absolutely fantastic. They help guide you onto the minibus, help guide you off, make sure you get to your front door or to wherever you're going. It takes all the stress and the worry out of manoeuvring to where you need to get to, especially in the dark. It's very, very reasonably priced, where the similar taxi fare of £5 now costs me £1.50 on the bus on demand service. And once again, the service is absolutely fantastic. They guide you where you need to get to. They make sure you're okay before they leave. Just a brilliant service for anybody with limited eyesight or limited mobility. Well, I hope that helps, and I'll look forward to seeing or speaking to people soon. Take care.
Thank you, Jack, for another helpful piece of information. The phone number for Bus On Demand, once again, is 0345 0348 670. And thank you, Jack, and for your messages this week. To Graham, I played you information about Journey Care on the 29th of October and about the reader service for the visually impaired on the 22nd, but they are worth plugging again soon because they are really helpful services. Well, thank you for your messages this week, and please let's hear from you next time. I'm sure there's lots of things you can talk about. What have you been doing lately? Anything helpful that you find, that you found that might be helpful to your fellow listeners? Or anything, that any thoughts arising from any of the items on Outlook, including the news. Thank you, but let's hear from you next time. Bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
So that's your Postbag for another week. Do please pick up the phone and send us a message. We'd love to hear from you. Elaine's now visiting Norton Lindsay, a village I know quite well, close to where I live, just a few miles north of Stratford.
The South Warwickshire village of Norton Lindsay is surrounded by open countryside and lies 4 miles away from the county town of Warwick and 6 miles from Stratford-upon-Avon. The adult population, according to the electoral roll, numbers just over 300. But that was in 2020, and they were proud to have won the accolade of Best Kept Village in the county in 1999. The nucleus of the village is around the main street and the road leading to the church. The majority of the older houses are in this area, and their names bear witness to the former nature of the village. Barn Cottage, the old barn. Stable Cottage, the old forge. Most of the former farmhouses, such as the White House, have shed their land, and only one working farm, Canning's, remains in the centre of the village, though there are others on the periphery. Holy Trinity Church, which dates back to the 13th century and has an 11th century font, stands in an oasis of peace and quiet, surrounded by the churchyard and the garden of rest. Since 1925, the parish has formed part of the United Benefice of Norton Lindsay, Wolverton and Langley, with the rector living in Wolverton. The village school, Wolverton Primary, was built in 1876, near the boundary of the two parishes. The school successfully fought off attempts to close it, and now flourishes with over 70 pupils, with its academic standards being among the highest in the county. The Western Gales account for the village's nickname of Windy Lindsay, and they will have done their share in turning the sails of the village windmill, which was built between 1793 and 1800, falling into disuse, it is thought, in 1906. It was here that an unfortunate miller, William Blakeman, died as a result of a fall while setting the sailcloths on the 14th of March, 1892. Now the mill forms an interesting feature in the garden of Mill House. The village hall is used for a myriad of social activities, including the youth club, the WI and the bridge club, not to mention parties, dances and dinners. Smaller social functions take place in the recently refurbished church room, which was originally a Victorian dame school. Another popular meeting place in the centre of the village is the local hostelry, the New Inn. Sporting interests are well catered for by a flourishing football and cricket clubs. Although the village no longer has a shop or post office, it is still a thriving and vibrant community.
And next week it's Old Milverton, just outside Leamington. Now, are you a fan of Strictly? If so, you will remember the remarkable blind Chris McCausland winning the last series. Recently, he was interviewed by Anna Bonnet about his journey in showbiz, and Sue reads the first half of that story.
For much of his life, Chris McCausland was consumed by the pursuit of normal. Born with a hereditary eye condition that steadily eroded his vision through childhood and adolescence, the would-be comedian never learnt Braille, wouldn't use the word blind, even when legal blindness arrived at the age of 22, and refused to walk with a white stick. If I'm not identifiably disabled, that gives me the room to pretend I wasn't, he reflects. So I masked my poor eyesight. I always made out I could see more than I could, and I think that desire to be normal is a horrible word, but that's how I thought of it, hindered my acceptance. It got me into more trouble than if I'd just owned it. All of which is why, 2 decades on, McCausland, stepping onto the Strictly Come Dancing dance floor last year for its 22nd series, meant quite so much. This wasn't just about a Saturday night booking for someone who was by then a successful comic and regular fixture on panel shows from Have I Got News For You to Would I Lie To You. It was about a then 47-year-old man embracing who he was as the first blind contestant on a BBC One show, which millions consider part of the national fabric, for a journey, to use Strictly Speak, that turned out to be one of the most moving in the programme's history. No wonder he went on to win it. Turned out quite well in the end, didn't it? He chuckles. McCausland is talking in the South West London home he shares with his wife Patricia and their 11-year-old daughter Sophie. We're here to discuss his memoir, Keep Laughing, which his publishers asked him to write off the back of the Strictly success. He's particularly pleased with the title. You've got a subtle little marketing link with Strictly because of Keep Dancing, but also, in 3 years' time, when it's in a bargain bin, it works on its own. I haven't called it Strictly Comedy or something naff like that. It fits his worldview too. It's about overcoming adversity, how to keep going in the face of things. You've got to laugh, otherwise, well, you'll kill yourself, won't you, he says, every bit as dryly as you'd expect. The book is a witty account of his rise in comedy and a candid reflection on life with gradual sight loss, an emotional honesty he thinks he reached only because of Strictly. If I'd written it a year ago, it would have been a different book, he says. I think I would have kept the emotion of losing my sight quite closed off. Coming out of Strictly, everybody had already seen him crying on the telly. It felt easier to write because I'd already let people see that side of me. The memoir took shape earlier this year while McCausland was riding the Strictly success and juggling a mammoth, much extended stand-up tour, Yonks. It required long hours at his desk dictating his memories to his computer. I'm really pleased with the result, he says. I'm never going to be happy with it completely, because I'm never happy with anything I do. But I'm as happy with it as I could be, because I'm proud of myself for being so open. After all, I'm a bloke who grew up in Liverpool in the 80s. It's always been very much dig a hole and bury things. McCausland was raised by a firefighter father and a mother who stayed at home. She, like McCausland's sister and grandmother, shares the same eye condition, which is more slowly progressing in women than it is in men. Sexist, he quips. He recalls large print children's books, getting lost after following strangers whom he thought were his family, and how for years he believed his address, 2 Cragside Avenue, was 2 Cragside Avenue, because he never saw it written down. He wondered how the postman knew which house the letters were meant for. Where I'm lucky, he says, is that sight loss was always in the family. If you have a child who suddenly becomes blind at 12, it's a lot of trauma, in one go. In our family, nobody had to get used to a single moment. So they always laughed at themselves and the situations they got into. McCausland followed suit. The day he wandered into an undertaker's thinking it was a barber's, for instance, and had a confusing exchange with the voice asking, "Can I help you?"
So we'll read the second half of the story of achievement over adversity next week. I think we can all accept the meaning of historical figures who are given nicknames like Ivan the Terrible, but Peter's now going to tell us how often we got it wrong.
The first is King Canute, the Viking Danish King of England from 1016 to 1035. And when you hear Canute used, it's often used in the phrase Canute-like, as if you're trying to prevent the inevitable. And the story is all about his foolish arrogance of sitting on his throne on a beach as the tide's coming in. And there he is commanding the tide to go back. And the tide doesn't go back, and he gets all flustered, and his courtiers have to carry him back onto dry land. And it's all rather to depict Canute as a foolish, strange, arrogant, naive monarch. It's actually that's the completely wrong way round. What he was trying to do by sitting in a throne on the beach and commanding the tide to retreat was to show his courtiers that the tide wouldn't. That in fact, even as king, he was not capable of changing nature, or as he would have seen it, or as he did see it, changing God's will. The story goes that what he eventually said was, "Let all men know how empty and worthless is the power of kings, for there is no king worthy of that name, except for him whom heaven, earth, and sea obey by eternal laws." So historians probably look at him like that, but in popular culture, to be Canute-like, I think is badly misunderstood, and I'd like to rehabilitate that particular king. I'd also like to rehabilitate one of his immediate predecessors. That's Ethelred the Unready, King of England from 978 to 1013, and again from 1014 until his death in 1016. Ethelred the Unready. The sort of term that's used to mock him, to make him appear a foolish, incompetent, unprepared king, and in particular in light of his relations with the Danish, because following the Battle of Maldon, the defeat at the Battle of Maldon in 991, Ethelred paid a tribute, a tax, the Danegelt, to the Danish king, and in 1013, King Swain Forkbeard, great name, invaded England, and Ethelred fled to Normandy and Swain became king. And the idea would be Ethelred the Unready, look, he's unready for the Danes, he's unready for threats to his nation. What an incompetent king he must have been. Except this is also a misunderstanding. Ethelred the Unready is a pun, because the word Ethelred means well advised. And unread, which is what the unready originally was, means ill-advised. So this is the nickname given to him to be the well-advised, the ill-advised. And it's a mocking nickname that didn't really come into use until the Normans in the later part of the 11th century, when they were trying to mock the Anglo-Saxon kings. And it might be worth mentioning that Ethelred's 37-year reign was the longest of any Anglo-Saxon English king, and wasn't surpassed until the 13th century, when Henry III reigned for longer. So Ethelred the Unready, Ethelred the Unread, was a far more successful, long-lasting king than perhaps his reputation gives him. Finally, we'll go to Europe, or rather to Russia, for my third much misunderstood monarch. And that's Ivan IV, Grand Prince of Moscow and all Russia from 1533 to 1547, and the first Tsar and Grand Prince of all Russia from 1547 until his death in 1584. Or as you might know, Ivan IV, Ivan the Terrible. Except the word terrible is a mistranslation. The Russian word is Ivan Grozny. And Grozny reflects a very different appreciation of Ivan's qualities. The actual best translation of Grozny would be awe-inspiring, powerful, formidable, immense, without any of those connotations of evil and cruelty that terrible, in its sort of common English usage, gives it. And apparently, Ivan the Terrible in the negative sense is again a product of propaganda by his enemies, in particular propaganda by Western Europeans in the Renaissance period, who, wanting to depict themselves as superior to the Slavs, the backward, barbaric Slavs, decided that rather than use the epithet Ivan the Courageous or Ivan the Magnificent, they decided instead they'd use Ivan the Terrible and make him sound like he was a much nastier piece of work than he actually was. Maybe we should translate it as Ivan the Awe-inspiring.
How wrong can we be? Now, 50 years ago, Angela Ripon became the UK's first female newsreader. She was recently interviewed in an article by Stu Kane in The People's Friend, and this is read by Elaine.
It was never my ambition to work in TV. It might seem like an odd statement from someone who has been one of the most familiar faces on our screens for almost 60 years. But Angela Ripon, who turns 81 in October, insists she never aimed to appear on the small screen. Her television career began in September 1966, when she joined BBC Southwest as a reporter. "My very first broadcast was terrifying," she admits. "I sat in front of the camera and delivered the report live. And when I got home, my dad said, 'To be absolutely honest, you look like a rabbit caught in the headlights.' I said, 'But it's terrifying. I'm looking at the camera and suddenly realise lots of people are watching me do my job.' Like most dads, he had some sage advice for his nervous daughter. He said, 'Next time you go in the studio and you have to look at the camera, talk to me. Tell me the story.' And when you think about it, all the best broadcasters talk to individuals." A few years later, Angela left to try her luck as a reporter in London. In 1975, she became the BBC's first regular female newscaster and the first woman to present the flagship 9 o'clock news. "I remember there was a lady called Nan Winton. I think back in the 60s, who read the news for about 6 weeks," says Angela. "She was taken off air because it was felt women didn't have the authority, the credibility, the gravitas to be newsreaders. Much was made of Angela's appointment by the tabloid press. It didn't occur to me that somehow, she said, as has subsequently been suggested, that I was really breaking through a very important glass ceiling. It really did cause a bit of a sensation. The fact that she was the only woman in a newsroom full of male journalists, which included Richard Baker, Kenneth Kendall, Robert Dougal, Peter Woods and Richard Whitmore, didn't daunt Angela at all. I loved working with all those blokes. They were terrific and so supportive. The relentless press attention Angela received was soon to be heightened. Within weeks, ITN, the news at 10 on ITV, asked Anna Ford to become a newsreader, Angela recalls. We became very good friends, even though the tabloid press would insist that we were rivals, which was a load of old rubbish. Anna and I just used to meet up and laugh about it. Angela's profile continued to rise, and in 1981 there came an opportunity she couldn't refuse. Because I was a BBC newsreader when Charles and Di were married, they asked me to anchor the wedding coverage, she says. It was a huge responsibility, but crikey, was that a compliment. She also interviewed the couple days before the wedding. At the end, I said to them, Your Highness, Lady Diana, thank you very much indeed, and I'm sure I speak on behalf of the whole nation when I wish you a wonderful day on your wedding and a long and happy marriage. Diana looked down at the floor, and we put that down to her being shy and didn't think anything about it. But of course, retrospectively, what I had said must have been like a dagger to her heart. Angela left the BBC to join the presenting team of TVAM, ITV's first breakfast television franchise. Unfortunately, it went pear-shaped, and she was sacked for a technical breach of contract after only 3 months on air. I didn't work for a year, she says. Then, out of the blue, I got an opportunity to go to America, and it was a heck of a decision to make. It meant being away from my home and my family for a year, but it was an extraordinary opportunity. Angela went and had a wonderful, wonderful year as CBS Arts and Entertainment correspondent. She was nominated for 2 Emmy Awards, winning one of them. I came back to Britain and had no job. Then I was invited to go on BBC Breakfast Time to review the papers, which I did. A week later, I was asked if I'd like to present a new quiz called Master Team, then Come Dancing, then Crufts. At her core, Angela is still very much a journalist. I think it is important that I still do a lot of journalism in my work, she says. For me, being a journalist means having the ability to assemble words in a way that tells a story, that is engaging, that is worth listening to or reading. Angela's TV Highs and Lows. The Morecambe and Wise Christmas Special in 1976. It was just enormous fun doing it. We had the best time. And depending on which set of figures you look at, it was either 23 or 26 million people who tuned in that day. So it did have quite an impact. And then Top Gear, 1977 to 78. When I was doing it, Top Gear was a magazine programme about cars and motoring, but it became Toys for the Boys. TVAM in 1983. This was a low. I very rarely talk about it, because it was a particularly unpleasant period of my life. If I ever get round to writing an autobiography, I will tell it as it actually was, to be in the middle of it, not how other people saw it from the outside. And her final high, Strictly Come Dancing in 2023. having presented Come Dancing from the Tower Ballroom in Blackpool all those years ago, in a way, it was very much a full circle for me.
Surely it can't be 50 years ago. How time's flown. A couple of months ago, Dave and Graham had a break in Hull, and in this two-part story, firstly, they find out about Hull's fishing industry.
Hello there. Graham and I went for a short break to Hull. Both Coventry and Hull, I've got a connection with poet Philip Larkin. He was born in Coventry and is celebrated in Hull because he was a librarian there. Well, on Coventry Station, there is an excerpt from a poem on the wall, on the platform. I remember, coming up England by a different line, for once, early in the cold new year, we stopped, and, watching men with number plates, sprint down the platform to familiar gates. Why, Coventry, I exclaimed. I was born here. Well, we've arrived at Hull Station and there's a magnificent statue of Philip Larkin. He's clutching a book, presumably of poems, and he's walking along with his coat blowing in the wind behind him. So there you are. So what do we plan to do in Hull, Graham?
Go to a gig tomorrow.
Yep, okay. It's a rock gig, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Sounds fantastic. And Philip Larkin was a poet and librarian in Hull. Welcome to Music City. Hull's long been a place where music matters, so quite a few groups came from Hull.
Some of the House Martins came from Hull, yeah.
Fine young cannibals, everything but the girl. The city's been the starting point for sounds that travelled far beyond the Humber.
The criterion's crammed and rain is his ram. Okay.
Well, we're speaking to you from Hessel Road. Mentioned in the song Ghosts of a Thousand Fishermen by Henry Priestman, and he mentions a pub called the Criterion. It's a song about the demise of the fishing industry in Hull. Hessel Road, and we're going towards Hull Heritage Museum.
Right. So this is the Arctic Corsair.
Yeah.
We have actually got two
that
models
is a ship.
Of. We've she's going to be the museum ship in the city when she's complete, but the home where she's going to, the dry dock, isn't ready at the moment. So I sailed in this vessel when I was 15.
Really?
I was galley boying her, yeah.
Wow.
That was in 1971.
Yes.
That's, and then we've, as you can see, we've got a display of ship bells, the Stella Altair,
yeah,
the Macbeth, and the Commander Nesmith from 1915.
Yeah.
This lady here, a paper statue, this is
wonderful.
Lillian Belocca. She was the head of the headscarf campaign in 1968 with the loss of the three trawlers. She went down to London and got us better standards and safety standards for the fishing industry. Indirectly, she saved my life, this lady.
Did
because
she?
In 1974, I was a crew member of the Hull trawler, the Ian Fleming. Here is a life belt.
Is that a James Bond author?
The company I was in, all the trawlers like Amund Innes, C.S. Forrester, James Barry, Peter Scott, they was all named after authors. I sailed on the Ian Fleming 3 days before Christmas 1973, And at 7:10 Christmas night, we was off the North Cape of Norway, and we actually ran into a mountain.
Wow.
Sadly, that night, we lost three of the crew, including the radio operator, who Lillian campaigned for to have on every ship. The skipper wasn't capable of sending a mayday call out, although it was compulsory in them days to have a pilot on board, because we was in the northern Norwegian fjords. He never actually picked one up. So, as I say, sadly, the operator that night who got the mayday call out, he lost his life in the water. Mm-hmm. The three men never drowned. The cold killed them, the water.
Yeah.
So, did you find that interesting, the Heritage Centre?
Yeah, very interesting, yeah.
It's very interesting. It just shows you how brave those fishermen are in bringing you a fish for your plate. In its 150 years of fishing, Hull lost over 6,000 men and boys. Fishing had a death rate nearly 10 times that of coal mining. And right near Queen's Dock is a very tall statue of Wilberforce, who was instrumental in abolishing slavery. Well, we've been walking around the whole city centre. It's been very enjoyable, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's been very good, yeah.
Yeah, so where are we off to tomorrow?
We're off to
Scarborough.
Scarborough, yeah.
Well, there you are. That'll be great.
And next week they make the short trip to Scarborough to visit the castle and go on a pirate ship. Now, as we're into November, to finish this week's programme, Elaine reads a short poem about this autumnal month.
I like the fall, the mist and all. I like the night owl's lonely call and wailing sound of wind around. I like the grey November day and bare dead boughs that coldly sway against my window pane. I like the rain. I like to sit and laugh at it, and tend my cosy fire a bit. I like the fall, the mist and all.
And that short poem brings us to the end of this week's Outlook. So from me, Nigel Hewin, and all the team here, it's goodbye until next week.